This October and next, Pope Francis will be focusing the Church's attention on the crisis of the family, seeking means by which the Church can help Catholics and all of society accompany and strengthen marriages and family and rediscover a sense of the importance and meaning of the family. In a particular way, priests are called to be on the front lines of these efforts in the remote, proximate, and immediate preparation we give for marriage, in the assistance we provide to couples and families in crisis, and in the overall formation we give to families in our homilies, in our religious education offerings, and more. One of the great models in recent church history for priestly promotion and care of the family is Holy Cross Father Patrick Peyton. He began the Family Rosary Crusade during World War II, stressing the importance for families of praying the Rosary as a family for the cause of peace in the world and peace in the home, insisting that the family that prays together stays together. He began family theater, enlisting the help of celebrities, artists, advertising executives, and others to help advance these evangelization efforts on the importance of prayer, the family, and the Rosary. Many priests and faithful in Massachusetts and from further afield go to pray at his tomb in Easton, Massachusetts on the campus of Stonehill College. To help us to mine the treasures of Father Peyton's priestly life and ministry, I'm delighted to be able to welcome his successor at Holy Cross Family Ministry, Father John Phelan. Since 1996, Father Phelan has continued the work of the famed Rosary priest and Catholic media pioneer, overseeing the Family Rosary Institute, Family Theater Productions, and the Father Peyton Institute in its apostolates in 17 different countries, 8 of which he initiated. Ordained a priest of the Congregation for the Holy Cross 40 years ago on Easter Sunday. Congratulations, Father John. Father Phelan is the past president of the Mariological Society of America and a popular mission and retreat preacher. A few months back, it was announced that in 2015, he'll be leaving Easton, Massachusetts to become the novice director of the Congregation for the Holy Cross in Peru. Please join me in welcoming Father John Phelan.
Thank you very much, and it's an honor to be here. I've heard a lot about Arnold Hall before. I have a sister, Pat Phelan, and she's in Opus Dei, and she's been here several times for retreats, and she's spoken very highly of the place, and it's a beautiful spot, and it's wonderful to be here. I think I should begin on a light note, so I want to tell you about Bridie and Father Murphy. Father Murphy in Ireland, of course, the tradition there in Ireland was that Father Murphy and other priests would come to the house in County Mayo, which is the back of the beyond in Ireland, and they would come on collection, you know, rather than pass the basket. They'd be coming, I guess, a couple of times a year to look for your offering. So he went to Bridie's house, and they sat down and they had tea together. And Bridie had been saving now money every month for her permanent wave, don't you know? You gotta get a permanent wave. And so she was saving up there, and she had the money right there on the kitchen table, and Father Murphy was there having his tea, and he says, now Bridie, I want you to know that I'm saving up here so that I can get myself some transportation. I want to get some transportation. So I thought a Harley Davidson would be the right thing for me to get so that I could come and visit you at your home, you know. And so that's my cause this time. And I know you'll want to contribute to this cause. And so Bridie says, well, Father, I'm sorry, I don't have any money for that. And so Father, looking at the little jar there that had the coins in it, says, well, now, Bridie, you're lying to me. I see that you've got some money right here. And I think that would be wonderful for you to give that so that I could get a Harley Davidson. And she says, well, now, Father, no, I'm saving that so that I can get a permanent wave, don't you know? And I really want to look good with that permanent wave. I've been looking forward to it for months. I've been saving up. And that's what it's for. And so Father Murphy said, well, now, Bridie, have you ever seen our Blessed Mother with a permanent wave? She says, well, no, Father, no, and I never saw our Lord riding a Harley Davidson either. I guess as I begin to try to talk about Father Peyton, and I do it a lot, so I don't know, it's Father Peyton has become part of my life, and I really... think he's been a mentor in a lot of different ways. I knew him personally. I'm in the Congregation of Holy Cross since 1965. And he was much earlier, of course. Came over to the United States in 1928. And whenever he would show up, there was this kind of aura about him. For one thing, he'd show up at chapters and he'd be in the chapel praying a lot. So much so that the rest of us felt like, well, maybe we should be in the chapel praying a lot. You know, he would pray a lot and then he would give his talk. And he really wouldn't get all involved in the politics of chapters and that kind of thing. But he was a very holy man. And there's just no two ways about it. It's amazing how in a cause for sainthood, you have to prove that again and again and again. All you had to do was meet Father Payton. You knew he was a holy man. And he just he exuded holiness about him. He was born in 1909 in a little town called Bunnyconlon, County Mayo, Ireland. Now you could be living in County Mayo all your life and not know where this Bunnyconlon is. And his parish was in Attymass, County Mayo. You wouldn't know where that was either. If you lived in a bigger town like Westport or something, you wouldn't have a clue where Attymass was. It's not on the way to anything. You have to be going there. It's between Swinford and Ballinagh, and it's a really back of the beyond place, like I say. You have to know a little bit about the history of the church in Ireland, which was a persecuted church for many years. For over 100 years, being a priest there was illegal. Practicing as a priest was illegal. I'm talking in the 1700s and almost spilling into the 1800s as well. And there were secretive masses held at Mass Rocks out in the woods someplace, and there'd be lookouts because there were bounty hunters after the life of the priest, and they could bring them back dead or alive, you know. And so it was very much a persecuted church that was the history. Now this wasn't in Father Payton's time, but it's the background from which he came. So this kind of persecution went on for many years, and there were many priests killed during that time. It's very difficult to get a hold of any records from that time. This is the Conry Diocese in County Mayo, Ireland, and the West. And if you remember, the Catholics were banished to hell or Connaught. I don't know if you remember that phrase. Connaught being that whole area of Ireland in the West, the northwestern part, where the land is no good, really. It's all peat moss. You know, that's all you can do is dig peat moss. You can't really grow much there. And there is agriculture, but it's very minimal. And it's a very difficult place, so that's why they were banished to there. The English took the north, and that was the best turf. That was the best land for agriculture and so on. So the Catholics were over there in Connaught. And the bounty hunters would come, and they would be searching for the priest. Sometimes the bounty hunters would dress up as women or whatever in order to find out what was going on and to get the secrets there. But the people were very good at keeping their secrets. In fact, they had what's called a penal rosary. Did you ever hear that? It's a one-decade rosary with a ring on the end. And you would put the ring on this finger for the first mystery, and then you'd go to the second mystery, the third, the fourth, and the fifth. And the rosary would be in your fist, and you'd be praying it, but nobody knew that's what you were doing, because that would be a way that the people would keep their faith during this time of persecution, through the rosary and what's called a penal rosary, because of the penal laws that were given by England toward Ireland. And so it's out of this background that the Payton family came. And so there was a way in which the Irish were trying very stubbornly to hang on to their faith, to nourish their faith as best they could. They didn't always have access to a priest, and so the rosary became a very important way to pray. If you've been at the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, there's a beautiful, just as you come in, if you go right to the left, in this Connemara marble, there's written there the tradition of the Irish and the rosary. I always do an Irish rosary check when I talk. So how many have a rosary right here? You got a rosary on you? Can you produce it? I've never had 100% rosary possession with me. If you were in the Knights of Columbus, you would owe a dollar to them.
Does this count?
This is just about 100%. This is really great.
Does wrist rosary
count? Oh, yeah.
Count?
Wrist rosary, a necklace rosary, earrings that are rosary. I'll accept rosary tattoos, whatever you know. So, yeah, even on the cell phone, now many people have held up their cell phone now. They have these things.
Rosary app.
I realize you haven't had a rosary check since the fifth grade, so give yourselves a round of applause here for rosary. And I thank you for doing that. You know, carrying the rosary with you is a statement. You know, I'm a priest. In case of emergency, please call a Catholic, something like that. All right. Now, Father Payton was the sixth of nine children in his family. It was John Payton and Mary Gillard were his parents. Sixth of nine. His dad was a great big guy. He worked on the roads, fixing the roads, which never were very good, still aren't very good, and are very narrow in Mayo. And he did odd jobs. He did some agriculture. He did some stone work. I think that's why the Irish settled in New England, because they loved the main crop, which is stones. to build your stone walls with. If you ever see in Ireland, it's just covered with these stone walls, which are the main crop every year. They dig out these stones and put them in walls. And then they're giving their property away to the children. And so the property gets divided again and again and again, and more walls and very small fields after a while. So people actually leave the island and go to the United States or somewhere. The father's health was not good. The family members all had to pitch in to help support the family. And Pat was good at that. He did not have a very successful educational background in his early years. He was at a two-room schoolhouse. And unfortunately, the family did not get along politically with the schoolmaster. So there were differences there, and we don't know how much of it was really Pat's fault, but he didn't have a very successful time in that two-room schoolhouse. And he was often kicked out or whatever. And so his education was very spotty when he left Ireland. The sisters, two of the sisters had gone to the United States early, the older sisters, and they settled in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Some of the stories, when Pat was a young lad, he used to be very dedicated to the parish. He would serve several masses on a given Sunday. He would get the very early mass. His pastor was kind of a mentor to him and encouraged him in his vocation. He loved the image of saying, you know, on a Sunday, it was like the spokes of a wheel. All the people walking to the center, which was the parish of St. Joseph in Addie Mass, and how they were all coming from different directions, but they were all coming together to worship together. There's a very strong sense of community within the place. As you can imagine, it's country, territory. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew more than they should about the other family. And so, you know, it's a small town situation. And so he would pray for them all, and he loved the parish, and he was very close to his pastor, who encouraged him to apply to different religious communities. He wanted to be a missionary. That was his goal, to be a missionary. Some of the stories about him in his youth, he had a girlfriend. Her name was Cassidy, and he had that option. He didn't know whether he was called to marry her or to be a priest, and he would go back and forth on this. And but whenever he got praying in the church, he was very strong in terms of his vocation. The thing that he appreciated the most about his family was that the father, every night, would kneel down and lead the family in the rosary. This was something that happened every night. And that's what's written about in the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. It talks about how in the west of Ireland, the tradition was you didn't go to bed without praying the rosary. And he would say sometimes there were more people than potatoes in the house, which meant, you know, we were going to go to bed hungry, but not spiritually hungry. The rosary was what would nourish us. And he felt that that was so strong a tradition in his family that he appreciated it for the rest of his life. And he promoted it, actually, with families. He wanted families to pray together. One time he was lent out to another farmer to help out. He was a teenager. And in helping out, they came to the nighttime and there was no rosary. They just went to bed. They had their supper, they went to bed. And the next morning, he gave his first family rosary homily to the owner of this house, saying, "How could you? How could you let us all go to bed without praying the rosary first? That's something that we always do here. And you really need to do that with your family. You're letting your family down, not praying with them," and so forth. And so it was very, very strong in him right from the start. He gave this lecture to them about how they needed to pray the rosary. Now, he also had an encounter one time. He was working for a man in a pub, you know, a pub short for public house, which is, yes, it's a bar, but it's really a family place, you know. And he was supposed to be sweeping the floor, getting ready for a dance that was going to happen that night. And he and his buddy got fooling around, and they were dancing with a broom, you know. And who comes up but the owner of the place? And fires him on the spot. He says, "What are you doing fooling around here? You're supposed to be working hard." And so he was fired there. That's one of the stories that's remained about his youth. Another one is that he was out in the field and punching a cow. Now, if you've ever worked with cows, you know that they can be pretty stubborn, and sometimes you lose your patience with them. So he gave a good punch to this cow, but his mother was watching from the doorway. And she really chewed him out about that. And he was ashamed of that for a long time to come. Now, Pat left Ireland when he was 19 years old. And it was 1928. And they had what was called an American wake. In Ireland, an American wake was when you were going to say goodbye to your children because they were going elsewhere for a better life. They were going to make money, they were going to have success, they were going to send money back to help the family to survive, which was very important. And so this is what was happening, and now it's called a wake because, you know, saving the money, like Bridie saving for her permanent wave, it was very difficult to save up enough money for him to come by ship from Ireland over to the United States. And his brother Tom with him, both Tom and Pat Peyton, came when they were young in 1928, and it cost a lot of money to be freight on that ship. I mean, they weren't going first class or anything. And at the same time, he was meeting a lot of people on the ship who he connected with again later in the States. But the family then, it was kind of a sweet and sour occasion. You were saying goodbye to your children because you'd never see them again. You'd never see them again, but they were going to have a better life. So it was a sweet and sour kind of experience. And at that moment, his dad said to him the most important thing he could think of to say. He said, "Pat, be faithful to God in America. Be faithful to God in America." I guess he had been hearing about America. You know, that it wasn't that easy to be faithful to God here. And whatever you do, whatever you end up getting into, be faithful to God there. Now, Pat had applied to two different religious communities. I really don't know what they are, but they were missionary orders. And he was rejected in both of them because the family didn't have a dowry for him to pay for his education. So the community couldn't take it on either. They couldn't afford to take it on. So twice he was rejected when he wanted to be a missionary in one of these Irish orders. And that affected him. He was feeling like, well, God doesn't want me. I'll go on with my life. I'll do something else. I'll become a millionaire in the United States. And so he had that kind of attitude going to Scranton. But his two sisters knew him well and knew that he had a vocation to the priesthood. And so they kind of schemed a little bit. Tom went to the mines, to the coal mines in Scranton. He had better health than Pat did. Pat was always, he always had bronchial problems. And so they weren't going to put him in a mine. So what they did was they made him the sexton of the cathedral in Scranton. The two sisters knew the pastor, and they worked this out that he would be the sexton. And he would come in early and stoke the furnace so that it would be warm in the morning. And then he'd have all this time before the Eucharist. And what would he do? He'd pray. And in the praying, his vocation would revive. And that's really what happened. And so it wasn't very long, I think maybe a year after he was there, that three Holy Cross priests came to give a mission in the parish, in the cathedral in Scranton. And Tom and Pat both presented themselves and said, "We want to be priests." And so the Holy Cross priests that were given the mission said, "Well, we have some other missions to give around here, but let us go do them. We'll make the circuit and come back and pick you up, take you out to Notre Dame, and you can study for the priesthood there." Sound like a good introduction to a religious community? it's gotten a little more detailed since then. You know, there's a few more things you have to do. But in those days, that's the way it was. You thought you were called, we'll test the vocation, we'll bring you out to Notre Dame and see if it's the real thing, see what it does to you, and so forth. And so that's what the two of them did. They went out to Notre Dame with these three missionaries, and they started to study. And they did very well in their studies, both of them, which was kind of surprising because they weren't very good in their education back in their homeland. But when they could really concentrate on the education itself, even though it was remedial at first, they did very well. Pat zoomed along in his education. He did fine. He loved the fact that he was at Our Lady's University. He was at the University of Notre Dame. This was Our Lady's University. There was a beautiful grotto there to Our Lady of Lourdes, and he prayed there often. Everybody at Notre Dame prays at the grotto of Our Lady of Lourdes there. It's a real center of the campus. If you've been there, it's really something, because a lot of people don't know this, that what a Catholic atmosphere there is on the campus there. You may hear other things about the University of Notre Dame, but this is one thing that's really true. 80% of the population is Catholic, the student body. And people are there not only at exam time, but throughout the year praying at the grotto. And it's a very important spot there. So Pat was just delighted, and so was his brother Tom, who also had a vocation to the priesthood. So the two of them studied. Father Pat graduated from the University of Notre Dame magna cum laude. A lot of people are surprised at that, because Pat, by his personality, you'd think this man is a little bit simple or something, because he's so focused. He's focused on prayer. He's focused on Mary. He's somebody who is totally disinterested in sports. You know, there's nothing about him ever playing a game of anything and having any interest in any sports whatsoever. In fact, he used to come. We had a place on Deep Creek Lake in Maryland, that arm, the western arm of Maryland, just under Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh, and beautiful man-made lake there. And we would have sports and everything, and he would come and visit. And if you know, some of us would go out to pick him up at the airport, come back, and you'd think, well, here he is, a famous man. He's known now for all that he's done, and we'll get to know him a little better. He'll tell us more about his life and so forth. We get in the car, and he starts, "In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit," and he starts the rosary, and we have rosary from beginning to end. And when we took him back to the airport, same thing. All it was the rosary. You know, you could talk to him about Mary or about the rosary, but you couldn't talk to him about anything else, you know. Even the Holy Red Sox you couldn't bring up.
Oh, my God.
So this was something. He was a very focused man. You know, this was his life. This was what he was dedicated to. And if you were in his presence, that's what you were going to talk about, too. So coming back to their beginnings in the seminary there, they had many who were their classmates. Father Hesburgh was a little bit behind Pat in his studies, the former president of Notre Dame. And it happened that on the campus, somebody from the local neighborhood, they lost their horse. And the horse got loose on the campus. And so the seminarians took the horse and went to this area, which was lovingly called Dog Patch. It was called Dog Patch because it was a very poor area just outside the campus at Notre Dame in South Bend. And so they went there, and they returned the horse, and they realized there were a lot of families living around here, very poor. And they asked them, "Are you Catholic?" "Yes." well, why don't you come to Sacred Heart Church? It wasn't a basilica yet. Why don't you come to Sacred Heart Church on the campus of Notre Dame? Why don't you come every Sunday? And they said, well, you know, that's kind of a classy place. People have nice clothes there. We don't have nice clothes. We feel out of place there. So they said, well, we might start a project to see if we can't start a parish in this area. So the seminarians would go out two by two and they'd visit homes, and they were working on the building up of a parish. It's Little Flower Parish. Eventually it was built and became a parish for the people there, and actually the people are doing quite well now. It's no longer a poverty area. And so Father, it wasn't Father yet, it's Ted and Pat. Ted Hesbert, Pat Payton are visiting a home one day, and Ted, telling the story, would say, well, you know, some people have a cloud hanging over them, you know, they're always depressed, they always see the what's dark about life. Pat was the opposite. He always had some kind of a blessing hanging over him. You know, things would work out for him that wouldn't work out for somebody else. So this one day we're out there and we're visiting with the family, and Ted's going, well, you know, we got to be back for Vespers. We're going to get kicked out of the seminary if we don't get back for Vespers. And Pat says, oh no, let's go to the next house. So they go to the next house. When they get back to the house, there's a note up on the board, which hardly ever happened, which says, Vespers in private today. You know, it'd be just that kind of thing, that this man had a blessing about him. He could achieve what other people couldn't achieve. He was ordained, but on the way to ordination, the biggest thing that happened to him, and what he repeated at every speech he ever gave, was the fact that when he was in second theology, he was studying at Catholic University, and he got tuberculosis, and it was getting the best of him. It was killing him. He was sick for a whole year. They transferred him out to the University of Notre Dame, and the doctors came to him and said, you better try prayer, because what we're trying is not working. And what they meant was, you're dying of this. This is not something that we can heal. And so Pat was really in the dumps. He was really depressed about it. There was another Irishman by the name of Father Con Haggerty who came to visit him at that time. And he kind of raised up his spirits and he said, now look, Pat, you're an Irishman. You got to pray like an Irishman would pray. That is to say, pray your rosary as if Mary were 100%. If you just think she's going to give you 25% of what you're asking for, that's all you're going to get. So pray to her the way the Irish do. She's 100%er. She can give you what you need. She's omnipotent by grace. And by this, he's speaking accurate theology, really. Mary, omnipotent by grace. It's not her power. It's Jesus' power working through her. But she's an intercessor in that sense with her son. Pat prayed the rosary. He prayed a novena of rosaries, and the seminarians were with him around the bed, and they prayed with him. And when that finished, it was the 8th of December, and he stood up and said, I'm cured. I'm healed. And they said, no, you can't be healed of that. That's you've had it too bad. You've been spitting up blood for all these months and so forth. It just can't be true. But the doctors gave him the tests, and there was no trace of tuberculosis. So he was convinced that he was healed through Mary's power, through the rosary, as a seminarian. And he said he had promised Mary, as a seminarian, if you allow me to become a Holy Cross priest, I will dedicate my priesthood to your work. I don't know how I'll do it, but I will dedicate my priesthood to you. And he lived the rest of his life in gratitude to Mary because she had given him new life in a way. And that was his entire attitude. That's where he got his motivation. He was already from a family that prayed the rosary every night. But this Con Haggerty, who happened to be a teacher of his, was the one who brought him to this new understanding about the rosary, the power of the rosary. That the rosary is a powerful tool. And so Pat, from that moment on, gave thanks to Mary, prayed his rosary all the harder, and tried to convince other people to do the same. And he was ordained. He was sent to Albany, New York, as a chaplain to the Holy Cross Brothers there. Now, I don't know how well you might know the Congregation of Holy Cross, but all of us who are in the congregation know that the brothers are much holier than the priests. So the brothers, there was very little to do. If you were a chaplain to the brothers, they were really giving him time to continue to recuperate. he was still worn out because he'd been sick for a whole year. Even though he had no more signs of tuberculosis, he still had to get his strength back. And so they said, well, you can celebrate Mass for the brothers in the morning, you can hear their confessions from time to time, but basically you're free the rest of the day. So he said, that's great, because now I can get started giving thanks to Mary. And he got started founding the Family Rosary Crusade, what he called the Family Rosary Crusade. This came to him in prayer, this idea of promoting the praying of the rosary by families in this country. He wanted to reach 10 million people. Well, how do you do that from Albany, New York? He started with a radio program. There was a Father Woods, who was a diocesan priest, who knew a lot about radio, and he decided that this Father Woods could really help me in this. Now, at every step in Father Pat's life, he went to the superior and he convinced the superior. He really had the Irish gift of gab. He went to the superior and convinced him that he had this special gift to promote the rosary, and that's what he should be allowed to do. Now, we've got educational institutions, we've got parishes, we've got all kinds of commitments that we make as a congregation. We didn't have promoting the rosary as one of our, you know, part of our charism or something. Although the congregation has always been very Marian. So the prayer of the rosary was a part of our community living and so forth. But Pat took it to another degree, to another level. And so he convinced every superior he ever had to allow him to go on this path, to create this rosary ministry. And while he was still the chaplain to the brothers, he had a friend who was a Mercy sister, and she was teaching secretaries. It was a secretarial class. And they all had their big royal typewriters up there, you know, and they were putting the letterhead from Father Peyton in the typewriter, writing a letter to Bishop so-and-so of Diocese so-and-so, could you help us to establish the Family Rosary Crusade in your area and around the country, and would you send us a check to help us get this started? And the bishops would send some support for this idea. They liked the idea. And they would invite Pat to come and to give a retreat, to give a mission here and there, and that's how he got started. He would have the rosary on the radio. The radio was brand new. The radio was just a new form of media, and people didn't really know its power. But Pat saw it right away. He said, that's great. You know, I can reach more people than I'll ever reach doing these triduums. He would do a triduum every weekend in a parish. He'd have this mission that he would give, talking about the importance of the rosary and so on. And he said, I'm going to lose my voice before I get to the 10 million people I want to reach. And so he says, the radio is going to help me. So he traded, Father Woods was a pastor, he traded a Holy Cross priest for Father Woods so that he could come to work for Father Peyton to teach him more about the rosary, about the radio. And he got the rosary on the radio in Albany. It was a big success. He said, this is great. I need to go bigger. So he went down to New York, and he went to the Mutual Broadcasting System. Now, there was a little bit of an Irish mafia in New York City at the time, people who were from County Mayo who could help him. They were on the city council. They were people who were heads of banks and so on. And they could help him out. They had a little clout in New York City. So they got him in with an appointment to the Mutual Broadcasting System. But then he was on his own. And his pattern was always, at the doorway, he would kneel down and pray his memorare for the success of his visit. Then he'd go in, and he convinced this Jewish lady that she should give him time on the Mutual Broadcasting System for a national broadcast of the radio. And Father Hesburgh and other classmates would say, you can't do that. They're not going to do that for you. But he went in and he convinced her anyway. And so she said, yes, you can have the time, but you have to have a big star from Hollywood to be on your program. And he went out thanking Mary and praying, and he was delighted. Then he asked somebody, who are the big stars in Hollywood? He had no idea. Who's the biggest star? So they said, well, it's Bing Crosby. So he said, good, I'll call up Bing Crosby on the telephone. And Ted Hesburgh says to him, you can't do that. He's not going to talk to you. He doesn't know you from Adam. You're the back of the beyond in Ireland. You know, they always say, you're from Mayo, God help you. And so he called up Bing Crosby, who was on the set of Going My Way or something, and he talked to this Irish priest he had never heard of, and this Irish priest convinced him to be on his radio program. And not to sing a song like Bing Crosby could, but to talk talk about how important it was to be a praying family and to teach your children to pray. And so Bing said, okay, I'll do it. You're very convincing. I'll do it. And so the day came, the 13th of May, 1945. It was Mother's Day. The preparation was to pray for peace. Peace was already in the works because VE Day had already been declared. It's Mother's Day, so all the families are gathered around this big piece of furniture called the radio. Remember the big staticky radio? I don't know if you're old enough to remember how these things were, the first radios. They'd all stand around there looking at the radio as if it was going to do something. And then these voices would come across, and on the program was the President of the United States, President Truman, then a message from Cardinal Spellman, then a big choir from New York City, then Bing Crosby talking about raising your family to be a praying family. Then there was the rosary itself, recited by the Sullivans of Iowa. You know who the Sullivans of Iowa are? They had lost 5 sons on the same ship in the Second World War. So because of that, there's this rule about you can't have another sibling with you on the same ship and so forth. All 5 of them were lost on the same ship. And so their parents and their sister were the ones who led the rosary. And then there was this Irish priest with his brogue who came on to talk about Mary and the importance of the rosary and how your family could pray the rosary together. The Mutual Broadcasting System had never had an audience this big. Everybody around the country was listening to this. It was just the right timing. Things fell into place. He got the right people on his program. And the Mutual Broadcasting System was now coming to Pat saying, you have to do more of this. You know, we love having this audience. So you have to do more of this. So Pat went out to Hollywood. There's a story about his, on somebody else's ticket, you know, an airfare that some sister found that belonged to somebody else and gave it to him. And he went out to Hollywood and he asked the taxi driver, take me to a Catholic church. He did. It happened to be the church where most of the Catholics in the entertainment business were. Somehow he got to be friends with Loretta Young, who was the biggest star in Hollywood at the time. And she was kind of the leader of the Catholic group in Hollywood at the time. She and Dolores Hope, Bob Hope's wife. And so the stars heard about him. He gave his talk at the parish. And Anne Blythe tells the story that she was listening there that day. He gave a sermon about Mary and the rosary and how he was trying to reach millions of people through Hollywood and so forth. And she said, I felt so sorry for that Irish priest, you know. He's not going to have anybody come to his talk. You know, he's going to give a talk tonight at the church. She was at that time married to this fellow whose name was Lewis, who was not a Catholic at that time. And he was a big man in Hollywood himself. But he said to her, no, you've already been to church, that's enough one day. And she said, well, let me go back. She went back there, she couldn't find a parking space, there were so many cars around the church. She had to stand the whole time to listen to his talk because there were so many people in the church. Mm-hmm. And then she had to stand in line with all the other stars after his talk to be of help to him. And he went back in 1947, he began Family Theater Productions in Hollywood with a donated facility. And he had a program that lasted 22 years called Family Theater. And it was tremendously successful. They didn't allow him to pray the rosary on it. What they said was, it has to apply to every family. We want you to talk about family prayer. So he did, and he had inspirational stories with big stars from Hollywood on every one. Jimmy Stewart was in the first one, and Loretta Young, and Jack Benny, and there were all kinds of different stars, and Wyatt. They all lined up to help Father Peyton. After a while, he was running this production house, which we still have in Hollywood, and you know, how was he doing it? Where was he getting the money for it? Well, they were all in the union, the actors' union, so they had to be paid the right salary. He would write out a check to them, and they'd endorse it on the back and give it back to him, and that's how he kept in business. And it was just amazing what this man was accomplishing. He had nothing to work with, really. And people would just flock to him and listen to him, and he would convince them. You know, it just would work that way. He was still convinced this wasn't enough. He had to do more. He wanted to reach more people. God bless you. And so he decided that he would do some rallies, some rosary rallies. And he started in Scranton in a small way, but the biggest one really big one that he had in Canada was in London, Ontario. And there he filled a big football stadium. And a lot of people came. They listened to him give his inspirational talk about the rosary. And he told, of course, the story of his being healed of tuberculosis by the rosary. That was in every talk that he ever gave. And how Mary was a 100%er, and that rosary was a powerful tool. And people were inspired. And so that all got written up in the UK. And it got around to everywhere. They heard about it in Wembley. They invited him to the Wembley Stadium, this famous stadium for soccer in Wembley. And so he went there, filled the stadium, had a big talk there. The people from that heard about it. They heard about it in India. They heard about it in Australia and in Bangladesh and all around the world, in Africa. And the communication system was there. And so people heard about these things, and bishops started inviting him all around the world to give his talks. And it was really amazing. There'd be a lot of preparation for these things. They'd take about 6 months. He had a lot of Holy Cross priests working for him now. All the superiors trusted him because he was becoming well-known and very successful in his rallies that he gave all around the world. So they would go in 6 months ahead of time. They'd do a lot of advertising. He would come in and talk to all the priests. He had six mountains that had to be climbed in order to have a big rally and have a successful campaign that he called a crusade, a family rosary crusade in your country. The first thing was he would have all the priests gathered, and he'd ask them to pray 40 masses for the intention of the success of the crusade. Then he'd ask them to have 40 holy hours to pray for the success of the crusade itself. Then he'd ask he would train 500 men to go two by two, house to house, asking people to make a commitment to pray the rosary as a family. Then he would visit nursing homes and hospitals, and he'd say, you have to suffer. Why don't you offer your suffering for the success of the crusade that we're going to have? So talking with people who might have been dying, whatever, and giving them new hope about this suffering isn't for naught. This is for something very noble. I'll offer my suffering for the sake of those that are going to be involved in the crusade. There's another one in there. What else did he do? I didn't write them down. The final one was his big rally that he would have. And in the rally, he would present a huge stack of papers. There were all these commitments from the families. He'd always do them in duplicate. There would be one for the wall. It would go up on the wall to remind the family to pray the rosary together. And the other went to the bishop to tell him how many of his people were committing themselves to pray the rosary every day from now on. And that, Father Peyton considered to be the center of his work. That's what he always wanted them to do. He also went to schools, and he organized all the schools. So when there was a big rally, all the school children came out in their uniforms, all the nuns were there in their habits. It was a huge Catholic demonstration. If you listen to the fellow who talks about Lake Wobegon, he talks about in his Lutheran territory there how the Catholics had it all over the Lutherans when it came to big public displays, you know. Because they'd be marching down the streets on this one holy day or something, and then all the Catholics would sweep in, and they had their Knights of Columbus, and they had their habits with the nuns and so forth, and they would just kind of out parade all the Lutherans in his hometown. Pat had a way of harnessing the way we were in the 50s. You know, as a church in the 50s, everybody marched together, and nobody ever asked the priest anything. You know, whatever the priest said, that was it. You know, whole different culture than what we have today, right? So everybody was marching together, and everybody was listening on the radio, and that's they were cooperating with this. It was a fantastic gathering of people that he could do. He had 500,000 people at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco in 1962. He had hundreds of thousands of people all around the world. The number reached 2 million in Sao Paulo, Brazil. It was also 2 million in Manila, the Philippines. He went all around the world giving these huge rallies, and before he died in 1992, he had spoken in person to 28 million people. This is the ones he spoke to in person. Then he had all his radio programs, and he had his television programs, which followed those. And then he had The Life of Christ, which he did in Spain. He did A Life of Christ, a movie, a full-length movie, which is still available today in DVDs. Mm-hmm. And that's something where you've probably seen this movie. It's the one movie that doesn't show the face of Christ. If you've seen that Life of Christ, it just shows the back of his head. And basically, you supply your own idea of the face of Christ. You know, and this way, it applies to everybody around the world. And it was fantastically successful. It's still available in DVD format now. And all his old radio programs, called Vintage Radio now, there are vintage radio stations all around the country, they come out with these things, and you can immediately recognize the voices of all these Hollywood stars in the golden age of Hollywood. You'd recognize them right away for their voices. A fantastic success that he had in his media efforts. He would combine the Life of Christ movie with his rallies around the world. He did a whole South American tour, which it's been revealed in the books. I should tell you about the books. It's Father Richard Gribble's Patrick Payton, American Apostle of the Rosary. That's the critical biography. All for Her is his own biography, his autobiography. There's another one called The Man of Faith, which is also about Father Payton. And these would be, they talk about in The Apostle of the Rosary, it reveals that he had CIA money as he was going through Latin America paying for his rallies that he gave. Now, did the CIA money ever change his message? No. I mean, it was the same message. And he, in fact, I don't think he ever knew where the money was coming from. His sidekick was J. Peter Grace of the Grace Company, and he was the finance man. And so he handled all the finances and even arranged for this CIA support that Pat would have going through Latin America. And really it was, you know, at the time, it was a very anti-communist culture, you could say. And this religious message, the government thought this really fits into it. And so that's why the support of the government was there. But Pat always had this very pure kind of motivation about what he wanted to do was help families to stay together. So his theme became the family that prays together stays together. In Spanish, la familia que reza unida permanece unida. And one of our guys down in Chile was always teasing me with the phrase, la familia que reza unida permanece aburrida. The family that prays together gets bored together. So it remains bored together. We do still in the ministry of Father Payton, we call it Holy Cross Family Ministries, because people would always ask us, why is Holy Cross continuing the ministry of Father Payton? And we'd say, because Father Payton was a Holy Cross priest. And they'd say, well, we didn't know that. Well, actually, Father Payton didn't mention it much. He mentioned that he was a priest, but he never quite mentioned the congregation all that much. So people didn't know it. So we use the term Holy Cross Family Ministries as our overall title. And then under that, we have Family Rosary in the USA, Family Rosary International, the Family Institute, Father Payton Family Institute in Lima, Peru, which is more direct service. It's social service to needy families, treating issues like abuse within the family, like addiction, like parenting classes and that kind of thing, you know, counseling for families and so on. Because you can't just tell families in a very poor situation, the solving of your problem is in the rosary. There are other problems that present themselves within the life of families, and so this institute attempts to address those directly in order that they can become a united family around their prayer. We also have Family Theater Productions still in Hollywood, California. The leader of that ministry, Father Willie Raymond, used to be at Stonehill College, and he's coming back from that ministry to take my place as president now in July. So he's been with us a long time, over 10 years working in Hollywood, and he'll continue the ministry as I go down to Peru. Pat was just a very unique character. when he would come and be with us in community, one time he came up to me, and I was a seminarian at the time, and he said, "Now, John, you're a giant of a man." And I'm looking up at him. He was 6'4". And he was looking down at you saying, "You're a giant of a man. Would you carry on my ministry if you ever got the chance from the community? If the community ever asked you to, would you carry on my ministry?" I'd say, "Yes, Father Payton." You always said yes to Father Payton. And I was honored by that. I went over to the other seminarians, including Father Willie. I said, "You'll never believe this. Father Payton asked me to carry on his ministry." And so the other guy said to me, "Oh, don't think you're so hot. He asked us to." No big deal. And it's true. At the end of his life, he was asking everybody, "Would you be willing to continue on my ministry?" Because he thought it was so important. And in fact, it is that important. It is that important. What we try to do now is to help people go a little deeper into the meaning of the mysteries of the Rosary as they're praying it. And to try to do it in relationship with their own life story. Because as preachers, you know, what you're trying to do when you're a preacher is apply what's 2,000 years old, the story of Christ, to today, to the life story today of your listeners. And it'll work if you know the life story of your listeners. But if you don't, you're liable to miss the mark. So what we try to do is help people who know their own life story to compare their life story to the story of Christ that's contained in the Rosary. We talk about the Rosary as a catechism on a string, as a summary of the Gospel, a compendium of the Gospel, as contemplating the life of Christ with Mary at our side, that's a phrase from John Paul II, as marking the rhythm of human life, you know, the rhythm of the Rosary and the rhythm of your heartbeat and the fact that your blood pressure will be lowered by praying the Rosary. It's physically true. The rhythm of your own life, so that when you go from mystery to mystery, you can pick out those mysteries and say, "I remember this mystery in my life." Your vocation story is your annunciation story. To think about, well, who was my angel Gabriel telling me what the Lord wanted me to do with my life? That's we pray Mary's story, and we pray the angel Gabriel asking her to be the mother of God. Well, what did the angel Gabriel ask of us? Did he come to us at our graduation party and say, "Get into plastics"? How did the angel Gabriel come to us and give us this message about what we were to do with our life? And that meditation is one that is a personal one for everybody that prays the Rosary. And I encourage them to pray Christ's life, of course, because that's what we're all rooted in. We're all trying to conform our life to Christ, and to do that through the Rosary. But at the same time, toward the end of the decade, pray your own life story in a way, well, how does the Lord get through to me about what the Lord's asking me? And there are different kinds of annunciations, even within the annunciation. For me, I was preparing myself to be a literature professor at Stonehill. That was my idea of what I wanted to do with my priesthood. But you see, I was leaving God out of it, and once I graduated from Stonehill, I felt like I needed to go someplace else to see what the world looked like from the point of view of somebody that wasn't an Irish Catholic from Southie. You know, those were the people that were at Stonehill with me. And so I decided to go to Peru. It seemed exotic to me. I knew nothing about Peru. And I went there for a few months, did very little for Peru, but Peru changed me. And coming back, I realized this was an annunciation for me. I didn't put it in those terms at that time, but I knew that the Lord was asking me to do something else with my priesthood. And most of my priesthood has been with Latinos. Because there's a need there, and because as a religious community we're able to be of auxiliary service to the church, and that's where the need is, that's where we could go. We consider ourselves educators in the faith, and so that's what our charism is. But the Annunciation, the Visitation, you have visits with people every day, and I can go through all the mysteries of the Rosary pointing out how they apply to our own life. Transfiguration is very interesting to me because I consider it to be whenever in prayer you really knew that God was with you. I don't know when that moment was for you. I know that for me during the seminary, when I would go home to a lake in Connecticut where my family was living, from Connecticut originally, at midnight I would go out on the dock and I'd watch the moonlight on the water. And I could pray out there for a few hours. It was just the perfect place for me. It was in the summer when I was on vacation from the studies. And I could ask myself, well, what is this doing to me being in the seminary? Is this the right place? Am I on the right path? I could talk frankly to God and God would speak to me. In a sense, I was seeing the glory of God in that beautiful setting and being able to talk with God. You've had those moments in prayer too. I don't know when they were. Talking to a bishop in Africa one time, he said, you know, the time that I was closest to the Lord was the day of my first communion. Remember that day? And how you were dressed and what a fantastic day it was, a very special day for receiving Christ, and how well prepared you were for that day. Who knows? Everybody has some moment in which they were closest to the Lord. And bringing it back in terms of a transfiguration moment, this is when you knew that God was in heaven and here on earth, all things were right. And you don't have that feeling every time you pray the rosary. You don't have that feeling every day. But you can savor it with these beads. You can go over it again. You can go back to it and relive it in a sense, in a way that renews you in terms of praying this particular luminous mystery. And carrying the cross, we all carry different crosses. Right now, my biggest cross is the fact that I've got to get rid of a lot of junk in my room, at home, and in my office. And I don't know how I collected all these things. I suppose it has to do with the fact that I've been working at the same ministry for 18 years, living in the house for 14 years now, the same house. And I never did that before. You know, when I was with my family, I never lived more than 5 years in the same place. So we always kept kind of light, you know, with what we had. And now I'm giving things away right and left, and the piles still aren't going down. So that's not much of a cross, but it's the cross I'm living right now. The transition cross, you know, and then I won't leave until November. I don't know how many going away things I'll be at. You know, everybody will be saying goodbye, and then they'll be seeing me next month. And you know, there's a song in Spanish that says, "Que estás, que te vas, y no te has ido." You're going. Keep saying you're going. You're not gone. And so I feel a little like that, and it's something of a cross for me right now. But this cross is all over the place. One of the biggest ones in my life was when my brother died in 1980. I only had one brother. I have five sisters. But my brother died in an accident. He left his wife and two-year-old child. And at the time, from the time I was in the seminary at Stonehill, I had put my rosary aside. I wasn't using it. Because after Vatican II, if you remember, there was this sense of, well, the, you know, Marian theology was not that important anymore, wasn't emphasized, or pastors were getting up and saying, stop rattling your beads during Mass, you have your own prayers to say, you have to answer the prayers of the priest, and so on. And people took that to mean, well, I guess the rosary's out. And so in our seminary, it was pretty much out. And I was working with a Mexican-American community in South Bend at the time that my brother died. I went back to Connecticut. We had the services for him and so forth, and then I went back to South Bend and tried to get back into my work. And I was paralyzed. I'd go into this youth center where I was working, and I could get nothing done. I would just think about my brother. I was grieving, and I didn't understand grieving. It was the closest person to me that had ever died. And a Mexican gentleman came up to me and said, you know, Father, what you need to do is what we do. And I knew what he meant. He was talking about the novena of rosaries that Mexicans always have after the death of a loved one. So for 9 nights, people come to your house and they pray the rosary with you. And it becomes a more and more social thing. And the last night you have a mass and a fiesta because everything Mexican ends in a fiesta. And so that's the process. And I said, well, you didn't even know my brother. Why would you have this for my brother? He said, well, we're having it for you. We know you. We know what you're going through. So I did it. I put up a picture of my brother and I invited people to come. And I was so moved by the fact that those who came were those that I had accompanied as a priest. They had lost somebody in their life. And now they were reciprocating. You know, this mutuality of ministry that exists, that we all know exists in our ministry. I was so touched by that. And when I was done, I was able to go into the youth center and get my work done. I won't say it got me over the death of my brother, because that kind of thing doesn't happen. I think what it did was teach me how to live with the reality of my brother's death. And it was at that point that I decided, well, this is a very powerful prayer. And I've stuck with it since then. I've had it as just a daily companion in my prayer, a method for myself to try to conform my life to Christ. And of course, in Glorious Mystery, we experience them too. The one instance that really speaks very loudly to me about resurrection is, I've done a lot of prison ministry in Comstock, New York, upstate New York, and there was this one fella I was going in to give some Spanish, celebrate Spanish Mass, and he'd be there with his guitar, and he'd always say to me, "Father John, I'll see you on the outside someday. I'll see you beyond these walls." And I'd say, "Oh, sure. You know, well, how likely is that? I get transferred around different places. I'll never see this man again." From there, I was transferred down to Brooklyn in Bedford-Stuyvesant as a pastor for 7 years. And after Mass one Sunday, this fellow shows up with his family. They've all got guitars, and they come down there grinning ear to ear, and he's saying, "Father, I told you I'd see you on the outside. And here I am, and here's my family. And this is the reason why I can see you on the outside, because my family never forgot me. They never let me go. You know, they never abandoned me in the prison. They never forgot about me the way people do. They often forget about the prisoner. It's just, you know, that one's gone. The family even goes on and creates another family or something. But this man knew he had the support of his family, and he came back to see me to show me that, and he says, the family is doing music down in the next parish down the road. And to me, that was a rising from the dead. This man was dead, he came back to life. And experiences of resurrection that happen in our own life, I think, help us to understand the new life that's given through the resurrection of Jesus. So that's the tone at which we promote the rosary these days, trying to help people go a little deeper into what the meaning of the mysteries is for them in their own life. It's after the example of Father Peyton. He didn't quite do it this way, but in his day, people would gather in huge crowds in a way that doesn't happen today. The biggest one we've done in my time was in 2007. We were at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, and we had 35,000 people there, and it was a wonderful thing, you know. But it was nothing like the crowds that he gathered. We all had the rosary together, and we went around the world in this mission rosary. Familiar with the mission rosary? Each decade's a different color, represents a different continent. And in this one, each bead, they were live beads, people in graduation gowns with different colors. And then there'd be somebody dressed in a typical gown from, you know, Philippines, let's say, and to say the first part of the Hail Mary in Tagalog, and then we'd answer in English. And we went all around the world answering in English until we got to Latin America, and then everybody answered in Spanish, because most of these 35,000 people were Latinos, you know. So it's a beautiful thing, but we don't have the same kind of numbers and turnout that Father Peyton did in his day. I think it's important to point out that Father Peyton had three C's, what he always expected of those that worked with him: commitment, competency, and consecration. He always talked about those three C's whenever he had anybody coming on board to work with him, whether it was a lay person or a religious, a priest. Commitment, competency, and consecration. That he wanted people to have the same focus that he did. He was a very demanding taskmaster, but very demanding of himself as well. I think it's hard to work with a saint, you know, any saint, because they are so focused. And he was a person who really lived that focus every hour of the day. He did claim he never committed a mortal sin in his life, in the speech he gave in Chicago. And he was somebody who, when you were in his presence, you were the only person who he mattered to him. He had a way of doing that with people individually, to really focus on them. It helped that he had a photographic memory and he never forgot your name. No matter if he met you sometime at a rally someplace, he remembered you later on. And people were kind of blown away by that. But they were always asking him to bless them and to say a prayer over them and so on, because they recognized he was a holy man. One time in Africa, he was giving a speech, and there was this tribe listening there, and people knew that the tribe didn't speak his language. They didn't understand English. And so somebody came up to this fellow and says, "You're agreeing with everything he says. Do you speak English?" He says, "No." He says, well, why are you agreeing with everything he says?" And he said, "Well, I know, I can see him. He's a holy man. And I know he's close to God. So I agree with him." And he didn't know a word he was saying, but he was still affected by the holiness of the man. And that's really the way Pat was. He was just amazing that way. So I should stop talking and I should let you ask me questions or give comments or whatever you'd like to do. Yes?
During that time of Vatican II, with the de-emphasis of Marian devotion, Father Pate must have gone crazy.
Oh, he did. Yeah, he was very much disturbed by that. And he used to go to St. Peter's Square, and the cardinals would come out, even at Vatican II, the cardinals would come out and say, "Well, what are you promoting now, Father Pate? What should we do here?" You know, the domestic church, that phrase that got into the documents of the Vatican, was originated with him. He also went on a campaign to try to make the rosary a liturgy, an official liturgy of the church. Because he always had this difference with people saying, the rosary is private prayer. And he'd say, "Private prayer? 100,000 of us praying out there? 500,000 of us praying? How private is that?" And so he was very much disturbed by that tone, you know, of Mary kind of being put in the back seat or something, or being taken off the pedestal or whatever, you know. And so that was very disturbing to him, but he prayed his rosary anyway. He got very friendly with Cardinal Sunens because he was a friend of the Graces. And but when Cardinal Sunens was speaking in his charismatic way, Father Payton would be in the back and he'd be praying his rosary. The two of them, I don't know how well they got along, but they at least understood each other, I guess, you know, in that way.
Now, you said you had a tour of Latin America, but he didn't speak Spanish, or did he?
Well, he tried. He got a few paragraphs together and spoke them with a brogue, and more or less understood them, you know. But he couldn't really speak Spanish, no.
And you haven't told us about his death.
His death was in 1992, and he was out at the Little Sisters of the Poor in San Pedro, California. They mispronounce it on purpose. It's called San Pedro, not San Pedro. San Pedro. The Little Sisters of the Poor and Mr. Hilton both offered Father Payton a room in their place anywhere around the world. And he often chose the Little Sisters of the Poor over the Hilton Hotel.
Yeah.
But when he was sick, he would go out there to San Pedro and stay with the Little Sisters of the Poor. And the rooms where he died in 1992 are the very same way today. The sisters kept the rooms there. He used to say Mass in the room. He had his books there in the room, and he would pray there. And they decided, he'll be a saint one day. We're going to keep this the very way it was the day he died. And people go there on pilgrimage to visit the place where he died.
So he was born out here. Now, what age was he then when he died?
He was 83. 83 when he died in 1992. Yes.
What do you think Father Pate would have thought about the Luminous Mysteries?
I think he would be on board with them because they're what was missing that we had access to in the Gospels. You know, we have great access to what went on in the public life of Jesus, so why wouldn't they be mysteries of the Rosary? Of course, it wasn't part of his tradition, and the thing was never brought up to him that way. He never campaigned to get new mysteries or something. So, but I think he was such an innovator, you know, that he probably would welcome that because it would enhance the rosary. And I thought John Paul II was very humble in the way he suggested it. He almost implied, well, the Pope's not in charge of the rosary. The lay people are. It's a lay prayer. And so you'll decide by your use whether you use the Luminous Mysteries or you won't. And so most people have taken to it very well, and it will be a part of the rosary in the future, I'm sure, that set of rosaries, but that set of mysteries, rather. But I think it makes a lot of sense. Some people used to criticize the rosary. When I was working with it with just 15 mysteries, they would say things like, well, you know, there's major things about the Catholic faith that aren't contained in those mysteries, like the Eucharist. Like forgiveness, which comes under the proclamation of the kingdom because it's the paralytic lowered in front of Jesus. So those things
weren't in a particular mystery of the Rosary, but now they are. And most of the sacraments are referred to in those mysteries as well. So I think he would welcome him in today if he were alive.
Yes?
John, have we ever quantitatively looked at the family that prays together, stays together, in terms of data that would persuade skeptical people today? I mean, in general, there's the stuff of if you're more religious, there are good things. But have there been any tests done on families praying together and their stick to it?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, I know that for Father Peyton, he would say, well, if people would come up to him and say, well, Father, we prayed the Rosary every day, and now we're divorced, and he would say, well, then you're not praying the Rosary together every day, are you? You know, so you're not praying the Rosary together, so you're not staying together. But that's kind of a backwards way out, I think. does it always work? I don't think it always works, but I think it certainly helps. I think it certainly helps families to come together over that. And he was so impressed, as John Paul II was impressed, with his father's prayer life. You know, that John Paul II would get up at night and notice his dad was kneeling at his bed praying the Rosary. And Father Peyton, too. Every night, the father would have the humility. He's the leader of the family and all, but he would kneel down and lead the whole family in the Rosary, showing that God is more important than his own leadership and his own power in the family. And that was very impressive to him. So I do think from one generation to another that Rosary prayer really has an impact. But in terms of like scientific studies that have been done on it, we don't have those. Okay. We're doing a CARA study now in which we have those kind of questions there, but I don't know that if that's going to produce it for us.
Yes. Yes.
Archbishop Rohde of Montgomery, Alabama, cited a study done in Europe in 2008 over a period of a few years. He wrote about this in an article that he wrote. Moms and dads who both don't go to church, and this is just basically Sunday, 1-3% of the kids will go to church when they're older. When moms do, dads don't, it's about 8%. When moms and dads do, it's 39%. And when moms don't but dads do, it actually is higher. Yeah. And then I just remember Scott Hahn citing a study that I use. I don't know how scientific it was, but he said that families that pray every day and live their marriage according to the laws of God in the churches, 80% of kids will go to Mass when they're older, and a 1% divorce rate. So,
and 1% what?
Divorce rate.
Divorce rate.
For those who pray every day, moms and dads.
Has his cause been introduced?
Yes, his cause was introduced in this diocese, in the Fall River Diocese. And
this isn't Fall River.
This isn't Fall River.
Okay, no. Sorry.
He's a Boston priest.
Sure, like you know. Sorry. Settle down.
Why Fall River?
Why Fall River? Because he's buried in Fall River. We asked Cardinal Mahoney if we could do it in California because he died at San Pedro. And he said he didn't do causes for saints. So we came here. We came looking here because he's buried here.
But he's not yet been declared venerable or servant of God or whatever.
No, we're very close to that. They're just finishing the Positio now. All the papers have been sent from Baltimore. We switched from Fall River to Baltimore because they had more manpower to work on this kind of thing, and they've done it several times.
Any before. Miracles?
We have two waiting, two potential miracles in waiting. One is a woman in Uganda, Africa, who was HIV positive, who made a novena of rosaries to Father Peyton, and afterwards, the next test she took, she was no longer positive. And that's been true for many years now, might be 12 years that we've had that, all documented by doctors from Africa and from Italy, but it hasn't been acted upon by the congregation yet. And then the other one is a gentleman in Albany who had a heart condition and wasn't expected to live through the night. There's a long operation at which all his organs shut down, and he still survived, and the doctors can't explain how. So that's another one. His sister was a secretary to Father Peyton and had the whole family praying the rosary the whole time that this operation was going on. And so he's doing well these days, too. And so we're hopeful about those couple of
miracles kind of in waiting that can't be dealt with until he is declared venerable.
And how did that woman and your daddy hear about Father Peyton?
She heard about him from an auxiliary bishop who came into our office in Uganda one day, because we're in all these different countries. He came into the office and said, I want to work for Father Peyton's cause. So give me some prayer cards. And I give, he gives retreats to people who are HIV positive, which are very numerous in Uganda. And so she was in the group, and she got the prayer card, and she started praying. And
good for her.
Time for one more.
Yes, pardon
me? Why is he buried in Fall River?
Why is he buried in Fall River? It's the community cemetery for the Eastern Province of Priests. All the other Holy Cross priests are buried there too. So we have to exhume the body and put it someplace else because there's a lot of other saints buried there too. And, you know, there could be confusion about which saint you're praying to. So, yes, please.
I was always intrigued by how he used, like, Hollywood stars to evangelize.
Right.
Did he ever get criticism from that? And secondly, did he have any criteria as far as their moral rectitude, or did he just use any Hollywood stars that would be on his show? And
He had a way of kind of avoiding ones who were in the crash and burn mode, you know, from Hollywood. It's a great entertainment for the United States to watch stars go down the drain with drugs or whatever, as you know. Now, Loretta Young had a baby out of wedlock, and that was kind of kept under wraps. You know, people didn't know that at the time when she was the main one supporting him, but there was a tremendous lot of respect for her. And she's a very religious woman, but he was very savvy about how to do that. And there were people who would have backed him, but he kind of backed away from that because of their public reputation. Was he criticized for it? Yes, because you know, you do anything in Hollywood, you can get criticized for it. So, but it didn't stick. You know, he was very much respected. He became this chaplain to the stars. They trusted him. He wasn't blown away by their fame. He did ask them to use their fame to help his cause, which was to promote the family rosary. But he never got totally enthralled with them. He was never starstruck about them. They were other people for him. Every time he did a movie, he prayed on the set before the movie took place. And I'd like to just finish by praying with you now, okay? In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Dear Jesus, Father Peyton devoted his priestly life to strengthening the families of the world by calling them to pray together every day, especially the rosary. His message is as important for us now as it was during his life on earth. We beg you, therefore, to hasten the day of his beatification so that your faithful people everywhere will remember his message that the family that prays together stays together. We'll imitate him in his devotion to your mother and ours. His mother and ours, and will be inspired by his holy life to draw ever closer to you with childlike confidence and love. Amen.
Amen.
In the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Thank you.